And I said,
He looked at you and...
Yeah, and he said, do you think they liked it? And I said, well, at least they did not state that they didn't like it. I think it was something like that,
yeah,
I said. And
right.
Barney agreed, and he said, I don't know. He said, Barney seemed to think, gosh, I think they were impressed. I really do. And Lois says, I'm not so sure, Barney. I'm not so sure. These guys are funny, you know. These guys are very funny with money, this is what I think is
yeah.
what he said. They're very funny with money, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a big investment. And so the next morning, Loewy that night had to go back, and Barney went with him to New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, well, now, Bob, he said, we've got to go back to the city. You have a big thing going on in New York. He said, and I'll talk to Mr. Vance on the phone. But if you hear anything before I do, you call me up immediately and let me know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Because they'll let us know one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And son of a gun, the next morning I went to work, and early in the morning I got a phone call, and it was Mr. Vance's secretary, Rachel Pellissier, her name was.
How do you spell that?
Pellissier. It was a French name, and I couldn't give you the exact.
Okay.
Probably ended up with an IER.
I'm sure it did. Yeah.
That would then be Pellissier, but they pronounced it Pellissier.
Pellissier.
Rachel, and she was a very distinguished looking, well-spoken lady, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's a funny anecdote on that. One, a little later on, speaking about Rachel for just a half a minute, and she was a very handsome, nice, excellent secretary. And long afterwards, when Churchill was president of Studebaker for a period of time during the period of the Lark,
mm-hmm.
I went to see Churchill one day. I had some thoughts for him that, and I was in South Bend, and I called him up, and I said, come on up, Bob. And so I did. I went up to see Church, and I sat out there in his reception area, Vance's old office, and Rachel was at the desk,
uh-huh.
Vance's secretary, and I said hello to her, and I was like old,
sure.
And I sat down in a chair like this, and Church came up behind me, and Church was an outspoken, you know, sort of a very manly type of guy. You know, he came up to me like this, and he took his hand and he rubbed my bald head, and he said, hi, Baldy. And Rachel just went, she just absolutely, this type of thing just killed that woman.
Oh, yeah.
She couldn't stand that.
Too
because Vance was such a gentleman, you know, mm-hmm. and a quiet-spoken guy.
Yes.
Church was just a banger, you know. And he was such a nice guy. I don't know, very few people know that Churchill and his wife raised 6 orphaned children.
Really?
Yep. No children of their own, and they raised these kids, and they all turned out
long before it was trendy to do so.
Oh, yeah, long before.
Yeah.
And they put their whole life into it. It's an amazing guy. Okay, getting back to this issue. So she was on the phone early in the morning, said, Mr. Vance would like to talk with you, Bob. I said, yes, ma'am. Vance got on the phone. And he said, good morning, Bob, how are you? And I said, I'm just fine, Mr. Vance. He said, well, I wanted to call up and just tell you that we have decided to put that car in production.
Great.
So, you're thinking about it, I get emotional.
Sure.
So I called up Loewy, and he was overjoyed and all that sort of thing. So that was more or less the story of it. And then it was a rat race to get that car engineered. It was really tough. So here it was in Clay.
Who's Roy Cole's gone by this time?
Stan Sparrow was there. Roy Cole had retired, I do believe. Yeah, he had not died, he had retired.
Mm-hmm.
And Stan Sparrow was the vice president in charge.
SPARROW.
Mm-hmm. Stan,
good man.
Excellent guy. He was well known in the industry. He was a man that he was a quiet, a Bostonian type of guy, or from the East, Rhode Island, or someplace like that, and spoke with a slight Eastern accent, a slight man, and long, thin face, not very big, but a very genteel, nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then one thing he'd say to me, now, Bob, he'd say, you work too hard. I said, what do you mean, Mr. Sparrow? He said, well, I know you're here night and day, and he said, I don't want you to do that anymore. I said, well, I feel good, Mr. Sparrow. He said, well, now just watch it. Do a certain amount, but not night and day anymore.
Mm, yeah.
You've had enough, you know.
Yeah.
I said, okay, Mr. Sparrow, and I went right on working just about as hard as ever, because my boss was Louie. It was a little different story there. But I told him, well, now, look, if I get tired and I start feeling bad, I'll go home and I will stop. I said, I won't push myself too bad. Okay, Bob, fine. I'd like to hear you say that. He's a nice guy, really an intelligent man, an excellent engineer. And he was a fellow that corrected the camshaft that went all to hell. It was his. And it was the camshaft, literally, that killed him, I think, in the final analysis, because he was so abstracted thinking of what the hell he could do to correct this very costly thing, that he drove his car and cut in front of a big truck coming down Studebaker Hill near the proving grounds. The truck caught as the rear end of the car and flipped it, and he was killed. Went off the highway, and that was the end of Stan right there. Boom. It was all over. But he was the case of where he probably didn't sleep for days and weeks and months trying to figure it out. Like my brother almost died here at Ford. I don't know if you know about that. Well, yes. Did you ever hear that?
No, I didn't.
Well, when he was first hired, he was hired by...
this is Bill Burke.
Bill Burke, yeah. When he first came to Ford, he was hired by... what's the banker's name? Went from here to the bank. He's the guy that started up the Whiz Kids.
McNamara.
Mm-hmm. McNamara. Now, wait, this is very funny. I don't know if this is... This might be of interest to you.
Very
but,
much so, yes.
Bill... When he saw Studebaker folding up, and I had already taken off, he asked me, where do you think I should go to look for a job, Bob? And I said, well, hell, Bill. I said, the short time you've been at Studebaker, he, by the seat of his pants and his own ability, he had become assistant to the vice president in charge of sales. Mm-hmm. And it was just going downhill. Mm-hmm. And this was a guy that Nance had imported, a personal buddy friend of Nance's. And unfortunately, I don't know, I forget what the man's name was, but Bill said, I've got to leave because I can't work and do a job for Studebaker anymore, because my boss, literally, this is, you might want to cut it out, he comes in, he's drunk in the morning when he comes to work, and then he drinks all day long, and he's just out of it completely. And he said, and we can't get anything done. I can't make any moves. And I said, I've got to leave. And I said, well, Bill, it certainly sounds like you should. And I think the plant's in bad shape anyway, undoubtedly. And they had blown, I think, 20-some-odd million dollars of Studebaker's money, not Packard's money, that they blew, and they had nothing to show for it, you know, trying to come up with something in any case. So he came up to Ford. So he called GM, and he called Ford. And the first appointment he got was with Ford, and in the afternoon he was to go see General Motors the same day. Mm-hmm. So he came over to Ford, and he went in and was interviewed first thing. Then they had him fill out a written type of questionnaire, I guess, or something to that degree. Yeah. You probably know all about it.
No.
And I guess that was a general, they interviewed him verbally, and then they had him fill out the questionnaire. And he handed that back in, and when he was done with it, he went up to the desk, and the guy sort of looked like this, and Bill said, here it is, it's all done, I think. And the man said, well, fine, that's good, we'll call you then, Mr. Burke. And so Bill said, thank you, shook his hand, and started to walk out to go over to General Motors right after lunch. And he got as far as the front door, and there's a speaker system came on and said, Mr. Burke, if you're still on the premises, stay where you are, somebody will come and... meet you. So Bill said, boy, I put the brakes on him, and I wonder what in the heck is going on. And he stopped right at the door, and presently somebody came down an elevator, and a guy came running across, and I said, are you Mr. Burke? He said, yes. He said, come with me. Bill turned around and got in the elevator with him, and he started up in the, I guess it was at the glass house, I guess. Right. It must have been.
It would have been, yeah.
And the elevator went up to the top floor, and Bill thought...
12th floor.
The top floor, one of the high floors.
Both floor, yeah.
Yeah, I guess. And
that's the top one, yeah.
I guess where the executives were at the time. Bill was of the opinion that that's probably where all the brass... And so Bill looked at the guy in the elevator, and he said, where are you taking me? He said, who wants to talk to me? Mm-hmm. So this young fellow said, I'm taking you to Mr. McNamara's office. And Bill said, you know, like, what's going on? He was all shook up. And so the young fellow ushered him into McNamara's secretary's office, and the secretary got up and she said, follow me, Mr. Burks, through this door, so forth and so on, and into Mr. McNamara. I would like to talk to you a moment. And Bill said he got all shook up. He didn't know what was going on. Bill was over 6 feet tall, pretty good guy that could handle himself, even at a very young age. Mm-hmm. He was a tough nut, too. He's not quite as emotional as I am, I don't think, you know. Any case, so he walked in, and McNamara said, stood up and put his hand out. And Bill shook it and was looking at him, pop-eyed, and, you know, and McNamara said, sit down, Bill. He said, your name is Bill Burke, right? And he said, that's correct. Sit down. And he said, well, Bill, I suppose you wonder what you're doing in my office. Bill said, that's absolutely right, Mr. McNamara. And McNamara said, well, I'll get right to the point. You were interviewed today, and he said, you filled the test out faster than anybody we have ever interviewed, finished it, and you in turn happened to hit all of the answers 100%. Wow. And I had left word down there that if they ever came across anybody that came in and was able to do that, I wanted them to hold them immediately and not let him get out of here till I had a chance to talk with a man. Uh-huh. That's why you're here. Uh-huh. And Bill said, gee, I guess I was lucky, Mr. McNamara. He said, lucky or not, he said, you're here. Now I've got a question for you. And I said, I've got a heavy schedule and I'm going to get right to the point. And the point is this. He said, I'm sure you know about the Edsel. Bill said, yes. He said, well, we have X thousands of them that we want to get sold. I want all of them sold before the end, the beginning of next year. And my question is this, Bill, do you think you could do that for me? And Bill said, it didn't take me 1 second. I said, well, Mr. McNamara, if anybody can do it, I can do it. He put his hand out and he said, that's all I want to know. You're hired. Mm-hmm. And that was the start of it. And he got him sold. Now, getting back to why I'm telling you all of this, is the fact that they found Bill, I think it was on a Christmas night at 4 o'clock Christmas morning, mm-hmm. on the floor in his office, bleeding from all ends, his mouth and everything else. He had hemorrhaged, and he was almost dead. And they took him to the Ford Hospital, I guess. And he was a young fella, and they didn't want to operate on him, so I guess they fed him with tubes and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And he was there for a couple of months, healing, and then he worked a half a day for the best part of a year, only. Mm-hmm. And I guess they really thought the world of the guy. The guy's a burner, you know. Okay. Just, you know, not enough sense to know when to stop. It's a hell of it. So that was the start of Bill Burke. And the reason he left is because Henry Ford, like he had done many times with a lot of people, had promised Bill the presidency of Ford. And when he told him that Caldwell had been picked, Bill stood up and he said, I put my hand out, and he said, Mr. Ford, it's been a pleasure knowing you, but now I have to leave, and that's it. And he walked out. And he did. And then you probably read in Automotive News that Ford, it was in Automotive News in print, that they paid him $25,000 a month for a period of, I don't know how many years, 3, 4, or 5 years, something like that, not to go with any other automobile company. So he went down to near Richmond, Virginia, and bought what I call a plantation, you might say, and filled it up with cattle, and he's sort of a dirt farmer at heart. It's surprising, you know, and he just enjoyed himself for a number of years, and then all of a sudden Reynolds, of course, Reynolds Aluminum headquarters down there, and they contacted him and talked to him, and next thing you know, they hired him. They wanted him to run Reynolds. Yeah. And now I guess he's president and CEO of Reynolds, the first non-Reynolds to run the place. I guess his salary is up in the $6 figures or better, I don't know. Yeah. Of course, he needed it. Anybody asked me how Bill is, and I said, well, he should be pretty good. I just sent him his check. I said, I sent him a check every month to make sure he has enough, you know. They think I'm nuts, which I am.
Great guy.
Yeah, Bill is something else again.
I'm sorry that it didn't work out here, because I think he could have done something
Yeah, I think he could have. Caldwell, I guess, of course, whom I just don't know. Bill didn't think Caldwell was the man for the job. He never said much about anything like that. He did tell me some funny stories about Ford himself. He had a lot of respect for Henry Ford II. Mm-hmm. And when he was in Australia, running Ford of Australia, he went from Ford of Canada to Australia and took his family over there, and he pulled Australia out of the hole over there. He did a pretty good job. Yeah. But in any case, there would be occasions where Henry Ford would have to come over and address a Japanese bunch of people or some people over in the Asia-Pacific area or what have you. And he said he was an amazing man in that he would do absolutely no preparation for what it was he was going to talk. He knew what he was going to talk about, basically. He said, and we'd get into a limousine to go from here to where the banquet was being held. And I'd sit in the back with Mr. Ford, and he'd say, "All right, Bill, read what I'm supposed to say." And Bill said it'd be a fairly long talk. And here's Ford, and the night before he'd been pretty busy doing some arm bending, I guess, and God knows what, and obviously not in too good a shape. He'd sit there and with his eyes closed, and Bill said, "I didn't know whether he was asleep or not." And I'd read this, and he said I'd stop and look at him, and he'd immediately say, "Go ahead, I'm listening, go ahead." And so Bill said I'd read the whole thing, just once. And there were figures in there, and there were percentages in there, and a few things like this. And he said, "Now, Mr. Ford, I've taken some of these things and abbreviated them, just in case you drop a figure or a point and you want to refer to it." And he showed him these cards in highly legible letters,
right,
and they were numbered. And he looked at them, and he said, "Well, I'll use them now, and then I want you to keep them for me, Bill." And he went through them, and he looked at them, and he said he did this. He'd listen to him, read it, and then he'd go through it. He'd look like this, close them up, hand them to him. "Okay, Bill, that's it." He'd go. He said, Bill, it was absolutely uncanny. He'd sit in the audience just all shook up, thinking he was going to mess up. He said the guy almost verbatim could he repeat what Bill had read to him. I don't know. Very few people know that. He had tremendous recall, I guess.
He's impressed with the job Bill had done at Ford of Australia.
Yeah, I guess he turned him around from a deficit to a profit no time flat, you know.
Then he went over to Ford of Europe, and he was impressed with what he did there, too.
Well, he created the Fiesta, I know.
Right.
Then he built the plant in Spain, I guess he, to build Fiestas. He did a few things over there that were pretty nice.
He was a real comer.
Yeah.
Of course, you have to do things like, we have some pictures of when Henry would come to Australia, he'd bring Christina along.
Uh-huh.
We have these marvelous pictures of Bill and his wife and Henry and Christina.
Yeah, there's some pretty wild stories. I guess that went down the path, didn't it?
Oh, yes. Unfortunately, it was not a good match.
Yeah.
But you had a good match. You and Lowy had a good match with that 53...
we had a lot of fun. I enjoyed working for him. I worked hard. I didn't get paid a hell of a lot, but I got paid enough.
You were paid by the Lowy group.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But I started out working at Studebaker, and I was paid by Studebaker, and then Lowy kept an eye on me and noticed who the heck I was, and he found out I was on Studebaker's payroll, and he found out I was a designer, not just a draftsman type of thing. And then he asked me one day, he said, "Well, Bob," he asked me, he said, "How would you like to work for me, Bob?" And I said, "Well, actually, Mr. Lowy, that's what I thought I was doing."
Yeah.
And he said, "Well, yes, Bob," he said, "you have been doing a nice job, and I like your work." And he said, "How would you like to go on my payroll?" is what I meant.
Okay.
And I said, "Well, it really wouldn't make any difference to me, Mr. Lowy, because I always considered I worked directly for you and Mr. Exner."
But he didn't pay enormous salaries.
Actually, when I look back on it, I think the most I ever got paid at Lowy's, I sometimes got a fairly decent bonus, which I thought was a decent bonus, $1,000 or $2,000, something like that, if things were going along pretty good. I think the highest I ever got paid at Lowy and I had 40-some-odd people, and I worked my butt off keeping the thing together, and I did an awful lot of patching up with some of the fusses that would transpire between engineering, and they were always throwing cutting remarks about Lowe, you know, right. Especially when Roy Cole was there. It was terrible, you know.
Yeah.
But the most money I think I ever made at Lowe's was about $27,000-$28,000 a year. Well, now you go back in retrospect and you exchange the money for the, it wasn't really all that bad, you know, really. So you'd take it by 40s and that would be 50s, that would be early 50s, and 50 to 60 to 70 to 80, what you times it by at least five maybe, or four.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty close to 100 grand in today's bucks.
Yeah.
Which was pretty good, and boy, golly, I saved money, and I did, you know, mm-hmm. You couldn't spend a lot in South Bend, and I didn't drink that much.
That's right, much going on in South Bend.
And I was working all the time. Oh, gosh.
Well, you had high hopes for the 53 Studebaker.
Yeah, and it...
great critical acclaim. Did it sell?
No, not very well.
What happened?
Well...
Was it that drunken Vance, the sales manager, or was that later?
No, that was later in a way, yeah. No, Ken Elliott was in vice president in charge of sales then, and he was a hard-working guy. And then there was Dick Hutchison, who was Mr. Studebaker of Europe. He was export, all export. Hell of a grand guy, Dick. I think there's a picture of him coming up tonight at one point. What happened is a number of things. Unfortunately, the car was on a 120.5-inch wheelbase. And we took our Land Cruiser frame, it's the biggest frame Studebaker had in their archives, or available, and pardon me, and that frame was a typical hat section frame, you know, it's a, like this flanges out in a piece of plate on the bottom, and it's called a hat section, not a closed box or a welded box like they do now. And you could support, if when you supported that frame by the two frame ends, the very tips, like the rear and the frame horns and the rear and the in front, the frame by its own weight would deflect 5/8 of an inch right in dead center. It was basically a pretty weak piece of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It would be termed a ladder frame without any rungs in it, you might say. There are very few cross members, and 53 especially.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was one point. That frame, however, when buttoned to a fresh all-steel, non-rusted body and with strong bolt downs of the body, and they didn't suspend the body over the frame, they in turn took shims, tire stock shims, that went between the underside of the sheet metal of the floor of the body, and there'd be a bolt hole through here, and there'd be one, two, or three tire sections in there.
Mm-hmm.
There were the holes in it to take the bolt through.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a direct tie-in of the body to the frame, so that there would be a little insulation, but literally none, because the bolt, you know, very little.
Mm-hmm.
And they used the tire things to literally take up a difference between a body warp of something that might be higher than it should be, and they'd have to bring it up to date with shims, and they used the tire pieces as shims.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then when things began to go, and the car... It was a pretty good ruster, especially in the front fenders and at the A-post, the floor. There was a body hold down bolt right in there.
Mm-hmm.
And after, this had nothing to do with the initial sales, except that the car was slightly flexible due to the frame and the body. It wasn't all that stiff.
Mm-hmm.
So if you went over a railroad track that you hit on an angle like this, you put the body into a twist and the doors would talk back to you, and they, you know, you could hear a few things. Well, the other thing is that W.W. Smith, who in turn was took Perry Sullivan's job and was in charge of the body division, engineering department.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that nobody would really be upset about this, but W.W. Smith took the job. He was a colonel in the Army, I think. In what part of it, I don't know, but he did not know what the 10-inch lines on a body draft were. He didn't know what they were, and he was in charge of the entire situation, and everything was done on large body drafts in those days when he took the job. Also, he got himself involved with suppliers. And at one point, I had you know, being an outsider like that, I had to keep a peace in the family, regardless of what the hell went on. But it's, a couple of times, I just, my Irish got up, and I really went to bat to try and save the day. In this case, it had taken a door latch and bought it through a different supplier and saved 15 cents per latch. And I got an example of this latch, and I saw in the body shop they were testing the latch out. And the guys that were assembling the latch and slamming the doors and doing this, you know, they didn't have any severe tests, but they pointed out to me, they said, "Bob, did you suggest that we use this latch?" I said, "No, I had nothing to do with it." He said, they said, "Well, take a look at this," and they showed it to me, and I said, "Well, hell, that thing will never work. It'll never hold a door shut, because we take the frame and twist it just a little bit, like we knew the car did, and everything would release, like boom." And so they, W.W. Smith, I went to him and I said, "Waits, we cannot use that latch. They either have to improve it."
What was your nickname for him?
Waits. 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 W.A.I.T.E.S. Actually, that was his first name.
Okay, yeah.
And I said, "We can't afford to put this in production." He said, "Well, Bob, it's 15 cents less than the..." I said, "It's not going to hold the door shut, Waits, and we're going to have real problems." Mm-hmm. "No, they've guaranteed me they can fix that on the ones they're going to supply to us." And I said, "Well, I don't know how they're going to fix it unless they change the whole concept of the lock." And, well, to make the long story short, the thing went into production, and they
couldn't stop it.
And later on, I found out from A. Baker Barnhart, he found out that W.W. Smith had a kickback from this latch manufacturer. It's terrible. Well, they lost, I don't know how many, of the initial sales, I think almost 50% of them. They had to shut down the production. That was part of it. Another thing that was bad on the car at the initial outset, it was primarily the door latch, was one thing. Another thing was some pretty bad fits here, there, and elsewhere in relation to the fenders, the cowl, and so forth and so on. Cowl to the front edge of the front door. It was bad news. See, prior to this thing, we had an exposed cowl section. The front door terminated, for instance, here.
Uh-huh.
And the windshield is here, and here's the front door, and the hinges are here. Now, we had an exposed cowl here with a fender here. Fender joint here, and on this car we took the fender all the way up to the door like you do today.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
That's right.
That was one of the problems, getting that thing lined up. And
alignment then, was it?
Oh yeah, alignment. And also the fact that we still had a few of the engines that acted up.
Some of those overhead cams?
Yeah, the camshaft.
Oh, the camshaft.
Yeah. And there were still some of those around. I don't know what happened. There was a group of them in the back end of one of the buildings that I guess the production thought had had the cams corrected, and they were the original cams, and they got into the 53s, and so they knocked out a few cams, and then the word got out that the car's got a bad engine again. You know, just crazy little bad things that were just out of sync with any...
Too bad, because it was a gorgeous car.
Yeah, it was a pretty car, but it left a lot to be desired. And fortunately, well, it took off at one point a little bit later on. 54, the car had been corrected, and that was a pretty decent car.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Put an extra cross member in it. Not enough to really take the movement out of the frame, but the original car had a very light sheet metal box section that ran along the bottom of the floor and stiffened the body so that the body worked better and worked harder. And then 54, that box was heavied up a little bit, but not enough. Then I took a 54, my own personal car, and I put a big box on it. It's about this wide and about this deep of fairly heavy gauge sheet metal in order, and that my car is just as stiff as an ex-member frame car. It's a really stiff car.
Uh-huh.
And I reworked the car after it rusted apart, and I spent 17 years on the darn thing, and I got it back, and it's a real going machine again. But a nice looking car. A lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of money.
Well, things are going to hell in the handbasket here at this point.
Yeah, everything is bad. So
discouraging after all that work.
Yeah. And then we patterned the four-door sedans, which had very bad proportions, somewhat after the 53 hardtop series, or the show car, so-called, and so on. And there were some modifications in the R-series truck as far as front-end facelifts on it.
You're still selling trucks pretty well, though.
Oh, yeah, they were still going along pretty good. Now, that truck is not too young anymore, but it's still going.
Yeah,
still
right.
They were good trucks, and they were economical trucks to run. They all had engines. Later on, they put the V8 in the trucks. Okay, now what else can I tell you?
Well, what were the internal problems vis-a-vis the design department at this point? It's the 54 picked up a bit, but there seems to be a general malaise in the corporation at this point.
Yeah, well, the 54 then became the first Hawk series.
Yeah.
The 55.
Who came up with the Hawk?
55. The 55 is of all.
Okay.
All right. Now let's see. So the 56 is the first Hawk series.
I was going to ask you at that point, who came up with the Hawk concept?
We did.
Did you?
Yeah.
That's
we
real.
Did. Yeah.
Gorgeous.
And actually, the Hawk concept, strangely enough, well, actually, the sales department felt that the 53 with a rounded off nose and the loss of a hood like we do today was definitely wrong, because we should be out there, you know, way out, and big hood top ornament and all that kind of stuff, you know. And if we could have put portholes on the side of it and got away with it, we'd have done that too, you know. So goodness, so that was a reason for the Hawk.
Was Brooke Stevens involved in that?
Not at that point. No,
a little bit
later on.
Yeah, okay.
Now, the year before, in 55, we did a Speedster series, and we used the 352 Packard V8 engine, which is a great big chunk of iron.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very heavy.
Yeah.
Not all that many cubic inches, but it was an overcast piece of iron. It was extremely heavy, and we put that in this light Hawk. You know, well, backing up for a minute, when I say light Hawk, even with 120.5-inch wheelbase, those cars ran from 2,079 pounds to 2,100 and some odd pounds.
Wow.
Imagine how light they were? They don't build them like that anymore.
No.
And that's I think it's a very critical thing to keep a car light, providing it's strong enough, you know what I mean?
Light is better. What
did you say? We had weight is the enemy.
Weight is the enemy.
Yeah, weight is the enemy all the way around the place.
The Loewy Burke accent.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Well, it was primarily Loewy.
Yeah.
It had the signs all
through. So how did that speedster go? Was it
was fast. In a straight line, it was murder. It would go. Yeah,
yeah.
In a straight line. But, boy, you just didn't want to take around a corner fast, I'll tell you.
Did you sell many of them?
Not very many. Not a few. It had an engine turned, and it had engine turned instrument panel, and it had a built-in tach and a few other things, and it was a fast car. Straight line just was scary. Because the other thing is you could break the rear wheels loose of that big engine, and all the weight pirouetting on the front, and the back is light, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the wheels would come up, and the tires would smoke, and oh boy, it's lots of fun in the back. Fish tailing, you know. Crazy nuts. I was always a great one for speed. I was always about two notches away from losing my license for some dumb thing, you know. And I have one son like that, and the other guy never gets pinched, and
really?
He drives faster than the other son. It's strange. I can't believe it.
The Hawk was a great idea.
And then we did the Hawk series.
Where did you get that inspiration?
Well, I'd say from Mercedes. If you look at the hood, you look at the radiator.
Uh-huh.
Sure.
Uh-huh.
That's a Mercedes look.
But it was a creative borrowing. It wasn't simply.
Yeah, it was different.
Yeah.
But the other funny thing that I mentioned, I think yesterday when I was chewing the fat over there, you didn't happen to hear that, or did you attend that thing?
I was
yesterday?
There. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But tell us for the tape.
Well, for the tape, we had a TriStar at one point on the 53, and I showed some pictures of it yesterday,
mm-hmm.
And the TriStar, Mercedes took exception to it. And contacted Studebaker and told them that they wanted them to stop using the TriStar because it was their emblem.
Mm-hmm.
And Studebaker said, fine, we'll drop it, don't worry about it, type of thing, because this notification came from a law firm in New York City, as a matter of fact. I didn't mention that, but I did mention the lawyer.
Uh-huh.
And So Studebaker said, well, what can you do, Bob? It's very, very simple. I said, I'll just take the tine off the bottom and we'll use the V on the top with the 8 and the S, and it looks just about as good. And I said, well, you know, before we put that on there, I think it was Vance I was talking to. Mr. Vance, I checked that out a little bit and found out that the Tri-Star was a symbol of Christianity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, and the Holy Trinity.
Mm-hmm, right.
And I said, in that regard, you think we still have to take it off? He said, just get it off of there. I said, yes, sir. And lo and behold, of course, Studebaker at one time were the, and that would have been their saving grace if they could have hung on to them. They were the distributors for all of Mercedes cars. Did you ever know that in the United States? Oh, yes. They had a contract with them. And their Mercedes were going to be sold through Studebaker dealerships. And that was on paper. Somebody must have burned it up or got rid of it. No doubt Mercedes, you know. Gosh almighty. Well, that's probably one of the reasons we certainly should take it off. And then all of a sudden, my next door neighbor was the German lawyer that that really got Studebaker to take it off.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, that heavily chrome front end, the Hawk, the next year, was a disaster, wasn't it?
Yeah, 55.
55, yeah.
I'd say that it wasn't too successful.
Yeah.
And that was before the Hawk, the model before the Hawk. We fattened up the hood
yeah.
and put this heavy bunch of chrome down below, and I think I showed a picture of it yesterday.
Yeah.
And then I tried to get them to cool it and improve the breed mechanically, literally.
Yeah.
Give it better trim on the inside and everything. Primarily get rid of some bad fits and bad joints and things that should have been handled in a different manner. And that's what I did with my car, and stiffened the thing. But in any case, so then we did the Hawk, and with that is when the whole situation blew up, you might say. And at that point,
The Hawk was a critical success. You certainly got a lot of publicity.
Yeah.
But for some reason or other, the sales and distribution ended it sort of...
Well, the sales department had sort of just been blown apart about that time, you know what I mean? And
that's what I meant, yeah.
Yeah.
Internally,
well,
yeah.
It was, it wasn't really doing its job, number one. A lot of dealers were having a hard time because they just weren't selling enough cars.
Right.
And they literally, if at one point in time, engineering, we had taken a Studebaker. Which one was it? It wasn't the hard top. It was one of the earlier ones. It was like a 50, like a 50 Champion.
Mm-hmm.
And we took the car apart completely, all the components of it, and laid it out on the floor in this big, the engineering building showroom.
Mm-hmm.
And we took a Chevrolet for the same year.
Mm-hmm.
And took all the parts, edging, everything. Everything was tagged, weighed, and no, we took part of a Commander. That's what it was, one of their bigger, more expensive cars, and compared it to a Chevrolet. And if General Motors had built the Commander, they could have built the Commander at for $500 less than they built the Chevrolet. And still the Commander was commanding Buick prices. So it just shows you how far there was a big differential in labor, payment of labor, number one.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a big differential in, so many darn things. The way they assembled this stuff, it was a disgrace in a way. You'd go walk down the assembly lines and the floors were mounds of packed grease with nuts and bolts in the mounds. And they were not level in a lot of places, just piled up grease.
Oh.
And gray light bulbs hanging down from, you know, it was really bad.
Mm.
At one point they tried to clean it up and then they let it go again and so forth and so on. But there are so many of these things going on, and there are many stories written about Studebaker, and I'm sure they're more accurate than what I'm saying, but I happen to be there and experienced a lot of this stuff firsthand.
Well, what was the basic reason? You've given some hints here and there, but if you had to capsulize it in 2-3 sentences, what would you say?
I'd say basically this, that when Studebaker made money, like in 47,
mm-hmm.
and the years that were good, and they did make money, they made very good money, and they in turn immediately took that money and they did not plow enough of it back into the facilities.
Didn't.
No,
did
they didn't.
Deteriorate?
They let the facilities deteriorate. They
physical
did
plant.
The physical plant deteriorate. They did plow a certain amount back into for new model changes,
mm-hmm.
and then the rest of it went into the stockholders, in other words, in dividends and one thing or another, to keep the price of the stock up.
Mm.
And that
at that time, that was considered the thing to do.
Yes, of course, and it still is today to a degree, mm-hmm. up to a point.
Yeah, right. You can't control it now.
Yeah, right. Oh boy. So
was it management? You had in the immediate post-war era, you had Vance and Hoffman.
Mm-hmm.
Did they did their successors, or did they pay excessive attention to the stockholders? And
they did as time progressed. However, when Nance took over he came from Packard, as I recall.
Yeah.
They did have money in the bank. They had. It was between $20,000 and $30,000. I remember, or a million. It was between, I think it was, as I recall, about $27-28 million
mm-hmm.
cash,
wow.
which for them was a lot of bucks. In other words, so they were not completely zunked at that time,
yeah.
you might say, or out of business. But Nance's group came in, and they just couldn't get anything off the ground, and they blew all that money away in a matter of less than 2 years. They had nothing left.
Mm-hmm.
Then when Egbert came in, and I happen to know Egbert at
Sherwood Egbert.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where did he come from?
Well, he came from Scott Atwater is where I met him. And of course I was gone then at that
mm-hmm.
time, and I did some Scott Atwater outboard motors
mm-hmm.
And got to know Sherwood Egbert there. And he was a great, huge, big guy, and he had a burn. He liked automobiles, and the poor guy, he wasn't only there just a couple of years, and he died with cancer, just rapid. Probably hit him in his liver or something. He wasn't a drinker or a carouser or nothing. He was a very serious, big man, and a nice guy, and a bright guy. And I think that, he...
Who brought Nance in, do you remember?
I don't really know. I really couldn't. I would assume that it was had something to do with stockholders, or the money lenders in New
yeah.
York City.
Yeah,
I
the banks
assume.
Were really
banks.
Controlling you at this point.
Absolutely,
they were calling the shots.
Yeah.
What had happened to Churchill?
Well,
Harold Churchill.
Churchill, you know, had success with the Lark.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they piled up some money for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Duncan McRae was on that project with the Lark.
Mm-hmm.
I know that, along with, it was mostly Duncan McRae. That was before Bill Schmidt or after Bill Schmidt. I don't know. Bill Schmidt was in it for a while.
Well, Churchill was much later.
Yeah. So, and.
Where is Lowy at this point?
He died last year ago, this last summer.
I mean, at this point in time, in the mid 50s, when things are looking bad. What is his position? Is he trying to hang on?
Oh yeah, they did the best they could to
yeah.
try and
mm-hmm.
appease everybody and
mm-hmm.
help them out, but
yeah.
They didn't want to have any part of Lowy. You know, it was all over.
Really?
Yeah, that is the new echelon. That is
Nance didn't care for Lowy. Yeah.
No, I guess not.
Yeah. And so things sort of just fell apart and,
literally.
With the Lowy group, and now what was your position here at this point?
Well, when the thing folded up like that, there were a number of guys that didn't have jobs, and
right.
we just kept them on.
Yeah.
And I took them to my house, and we had about four or five guys working in my big basement. And,
really?
Yeah, we tried to scrounge up some work around there and this, that, and the other. Little by little, they all got themselves settled with Ford or GM or somebody else, you know. And
remember some of their names?
Oh, yeah. Bob Cota was there for a while, and who the hell else?
He caught on at Ford, I think.
Yeah, he did.
Uh-huh.
That's who else worked in the basement? John Cuccio.
Cuccio. Cuccio,
yeah. And he worked at Ford.
Yeah.
He finally came to Ford.
Uh-huh.
And who the hell, heck else? I'm trying to think now. Kurt Bohm was in the basement.
Uh-huh.
Those three guys in particular, and there might have been one or two others for a very short period
mm-hmm.
of time, you know.
This is the beginning of the Bob Burke Associates.
Well, no, not really at this point. And so we fiddle around, and we'd get a few jobs from Lowy's in Chicago or New York, and we'd work on these things, and we were making money for the old man, and these guys were getting paid,
mm-hmm.
working in this crazy basement situation. And then, after they all got jobs, stabilized, Lowy wanted to hang on to me.
Oh, good.
And
even though the Studebaker contract was gone.
That was gone, mm-hmm. yeah. I guess he had hopes of doing something for somebody someday that I could handle for him. Of course, he knew he'd tried me. He had used me on many variety of things as far as products are concerned. I worked on the Greyhound bus, a scenic cruiser.
Did you really?
Yeah, when I was the head man of Studebaker, so I was busy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Once in a while, I'd go to Chicago and meet Barney out there, and we had a huge, big scenic cruiser bus, Buck, built,
yes.
and we made the thing out of wood, and... it was, then it went into production. That was a fantastic bus.
Yeah.
It was really, I
did
you
have
a,
any input into the design?
Oh, yeah.
You did?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I worked on it quite a bit.
That's quite a...
The details of this, that, and the other thing, and goodness, you know, there's so many things. And I did a bus for another, later on I did a bus for Greyhound.
Mm-hmm.
That was when I had my own business, and that was built by Mack.
Really?
Mack Trucks, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they were great bus builders.
Mm-hmm.
And they did... bus for Greyhound. I haven't got any pictures of that. I've got so many slides at home. You could sit for 5 hours and look at stuff, you know.
You should think about putting them in an institution that can take care of them.
Well, why not? They're sitting in my garage right now.
Right here, we have a marvelous design history archives that we're
Do
looking
you really?
For that sort of thing. Yes.
I've got drawers full of slides.
The Bob
Burke Memorial. This corner where I had my accident, the neighbors all call it the Bob Burke Memorial Corner.
Oh my
I almost kicked the bucket. Can you imagine that?
Bridgeport?
No, it was in Westport.
Or Westport.
Right? Yeah.
Well, Lowy wanted to keep you on.
That's right. So I went to the Chicago office, and I worked under Franz Wagner, who ran the Chicago office.
What's his first name?
Franz, F-R-A-N-Z. And he is half German and half Mexican.
Really?
Yeah, as what his parentage was. And he's a well-educated, tremendous promoter type of individual,
mm-hmm.
handsome guy, a highly qualified man that ran Lowy's Chicago office and took care of a lot of accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And I would live in Chicago during the week and go home on the weekends. And of course I had family in Chicago, which is a little bit different. And my wife did too. We both came from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was there for not too long.
Mm-hmm.
1, 2, 3. At the most 5 months, and
mm-hmm.
it was more like, I think, 4.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, I had this thing I wanted to try it on my own, you know, real stupid. I'm 40 years old, you know, I'm just a kid.
So of course you are.
Really stupid. Well, in any case, I wanted to try it on my own. So I contacted the Claire Hodgman.
Your
and we
buddy.
Always kept in contact.
Your
you
old
know?
Buddy from GM.
Yeah, the old buddy from GM that came into Sears Roebuck, and he made great money there as a young fellow. He was paid.
That's right, he stayed at Sears.
Yeah, he stayed on at Sears.
Right, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went to work for, actually, the Army, I guess it was. Yeah, he did. And he did engineering work for them on the drawing board, just like I did for the Tilly division and engine testing. He had a tremendous salary at Sears Roebuck. They really thought the world of this guy. He was great. He was good. So I got together with Claire, and Claire was back with Lowy in New York City.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, and he was handling Frigidaire accounts and doing a lot of work for Coca-Cola and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I talked to him, and we decided to go try it. And he said, you have any accounts in your pocket? And I said, no, Clara, how about you? He said, no, I haven't got a thing.
Perfect
and,
way to start.
Yeah, and I said, well, I'll tell you one thing I don't want to do is I don't want to start trying to get accounts away from Lowy. If they got a hold of us, unsolicited by us, and they want us to do some work for them, that's one thing. But we won't go after them because they are accounts that... had been feeding us indirectly through Mr. Lowy for years, and Claire was the same type of guy as I was, and we just didn't do that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we had to start out fresh, and believe me, it was nothing but beans. It was very tough, and here's a guy from the Midwest going into the heart of New York City, Oikave.
Right.
As they say. And Claire, of course, was more established there. He lived in Mamaroneck, New York, and I had to find a house, and I couldn't sell my house in South Bend. Things were down.
Sure. Yeah.
So I had a lump there that I owed a bundle on, and I had to go get up another place, and I moved my family, and I used to drive from... And I lived at Claire's house for the number of months, and I used to drive back...
Mamaroneck, north of...
just north. It's about... 28 to 30 miles north of New York City.
Wingfoot Golf Course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beautiful golf course there. Well, you know the area.
No, I just read about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, so on the weekends, I'd drive back to South Bend, and I'd fill up a station where I had a 55 Ford Wagonism point. I'd fill that thing up, and what a wonderful car that thing was, and I'd drive it back
for... Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah, great
Gosh, it was a tough automobile. Mm-hmm. Really tough. That's when they had the good V8 engine. The year before, they had a rotten one.
Right, they finally got
it. I got lucky on that. Anyhow, so I used to drive there over the weekend. I made it from Mamaroneck to South Bend. The fastest time I ever made was 11 hours. And I'd go from tankful to tankful, you know.
Oh,
like
yes, that. I know that.
and then the last 100 miles or so, the last 100 miles or so were just two-lane blacktop roads. It wasn't express all the way in. Pretty wild. I think we're doing a fairly good job of covering it.
We've got another 10 minutes.
All right, so I'm in no rush to go.
Hurt.
Oh, you do? Well, okay. And then the other thing I could do is if you have a blank in there and you want me to fill it out, just give me a buzz on the phone and tell me, and I'll make a tape for you and try to fill it out for you.
Well, I might give you a couple of tapes to take home with you, if you don't mind.
To listen to?
No, to do.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's all right. I can buy one. Well, I think I got enough bucks left.
Well, we got a little time here to talk about husband birth.
All right, fine. Then I could do that. In other words, you see a blank after you hear all of this and you want more.
Yeah.
Then you'll get a hold of me and I will do it. In the meantime, I can buy my own tape for you. And,
oh, we got lots of them.
Well, all right. So we started this business up and... we started out at 57th and 5th Avenue in an old building there in the corner, and some young promoter had purchased or had contracted for an area on a certain floor and took the area and divided it all up, and we in essence worked down a hallway, you might say, that he put a door on the end of the hall, and he rented that to us. So we had a hallway type of office. You came in the front door, and there was a secretary there at a small desk. Her name was Jackie, and I forget what her last name was, and she was a secretary to Claire when he was at Lowy's.
Uh-huh.
And she was very proficient. She helped us by feeding us, I guess, more
right,
than anything.
Yeah.
So, and then you walked maybe 7 feet, and there was a door, and you walked through a little... conference room that was about as long as from here to the end of the wall.
Uh-huh.
And our total office is about the width of this, maybe, or narrower. And then you walk through the conference room through another door, and we had one office with a desk and, you know, for calling up people and this, that, and the other thing. And you walk through that one to a drafting room, and there were three drafting tables in there, Claire at one, me at the other, and it was just a hallway. And so we worked there, and we were in that spot for...
Things began to fall into place pretty soon, though, didn't they?
Well, no, it took us almost 6 months to get a job in there.
Uh-huh.
And surprising, I sent out a lot of letters here, there, and elsewhere, told them our background and, you know, all of the kind
sure.
of a written thing, and the,
right.
most of them go in a wastebasket, but once in a while
somebody
had a little time.
Uh-huh.
And try to get it all on one sheet and not make it too lengthy, and a list of those things that we did. And lo and behold, I got a call from Coolerator Corporation in Albion, Michigan.
What did they make?
They, in turn, made window air conditioners, electric fans,
mm-hmm.
space heaters. Primarily, that was those were their main lines, and they were suppliers to Montgomery Ward's primarily, and Sears Roebuck secondarily,
uh-huh.
plus they had their own line,
mm.
which they called Coolerator.
I remember that.
And a fellow by the name of J. John Lonergan, L-O-N-E-R-G-A-N, is a great, huge, dark-haired Irishman, well into his 50s, with two grown sons that worked at the factory. And John Lonergan contacted me one day, called me up on the phone. He said, Bob Burke? I said, yes, sir. He said, I'm John Lonergan. I said, yes, I sent you a letter, Mr. Lonergan, I remember. And he said, well, yes, and it's right here in front of me. And you say you've had experience doing this, that, and the other thing, and you say you worked for Sears at one time? I said, yes, I did. I said, when I first started working, I was there for 4 years. And he said, He said, well, we're having a problem here, and maybe you could help us. And I said, well, I'd be delighted if I can. And I was so damn excited because this was the difference between beans and maybe a hamburger, you know?
Right.
So Big John Lonergan said, well, look, when could you come out and see me? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, I'm driving out to South Bend. I have a house. I explained that I had worked at Studebaker, and I have a house in South Bend, and little by little, I'm moving parts and components of it back east, and I come home to see my family practically every weekend, and you're in Albion, and that's close by. And I said, I'd be happy to be there next Monday. Actually, what had happened, I had already moved my family, and I was still going back to the home place because I hadn't sold it yet. And I was still picking some stuff up and bringing them east.
Sure.
And he said, well, that's fine. What time do you think you can get here? And I said, well, I'm sure I could get there shortly after lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, that sounds good to me. He said, I'll be here. And he said, no, drive carefully. I said, okay, I'll see you Monday. And this was like a Thursday. So I told Claire about, at least I got somebody that's going to listen to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started out, and I drove the 55 Ford all the way to South Bend, and I loaded the darn thing up. Wait a minute. No, I had not loaded. Yes, I did. I loaded it up. That's right. And then I drove the car, and I was going to stay somewhere close to Albion.
Mm-hmm.
I can't quite recollect, but I had to go through Michigan City because I was some. I know why. Because I had. Wait a minute. Yeah, I had started out early, and I went to Wheel McLean, the furnace manufacturers in Michigan City, Indiana, and talked with them.
Mm-hmm.
W-E-I-L, or Weil, Weil McLean, I think, call it.
M-C-
that's, yeah.
L-E-A-N?
Yes,
yeah.
Right. And they make boilers and that stuff of that nature. And I thought maybe I could do something for them. Well, I talked with them, and after I got through talking with them.
You took 12, probably up to.
Yeah, I had to drive Albion. Through the center of Michigan City. And I saw them late in the day. Now, wait a minute. I was to see them in the morning. Monday morning, that was it, and I was to see Lonergan Monday afternoon.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so I was drove all the way to Michigan City, and I was going to stay overnight in a motel or some darn thing, and go to Wild McLean in the morning. I had to, you know, had to fill a day up with contacts.
Well,
if I get, boy,
sure.
Was that important? It was eye hustling. Wow,
yeah,
goodness
yeah.
Gracious! So I came into Michigan City. It was quite late at night. Oh gosh, and this 55 Ford, and I was tired as hell, and I drove down the main street, and the South Bend Interurban crosses the main street, comes between two brick buildings, and I'm driving down the street, and there is no flagman, no ding-dong, nothing, no sign, nothing, and I go across this railroad track, and as I passed, went over the railroad track, in the corner of my eye, I saw this big headlight loom and come out of between the two buildings at maybe 2 miles an hour, very slow, fortunately.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether the thing was coasting in or what. I don't know, but in case, any case, it caught the right rear fender of the Ford and just behind the rear wheel, fortunately, and just pushed everything in like, wow, bam, you know, and the car pirouetted around like this. And the train just went past, and I'm looking at the train, and I'm facing the other direction. It didn't hurt me at all, but the car, I thought, oh, my God, you know. I got out, and the car ran, and I backed it up and pulled it to the curb and got out and looked at it, and I thought, oh, my God, you know, it's I don't know, what am I going to do, and so on and so on. Fortunately, it was all sheet metal damage.
Oh, great.
No leak in the gas tank, nothing, and I drove the car and slept that night, went to Wild McLean the next day with this busted up automobile. It looked like a terrible wreck, right, you know. And the next day, I met Lonergan, and then the thing that was really amazing is I went into his office, and he was a big, friendly, comfortable, big man. I remember the guy, he had feet, is it all over?
No, let's go a little faster.
A little faster, and...
if there's anything, go ahead.
All right, so in any case, he immediately had me sit down and showed me a series of window air conditioners, and he said, this is the problem. We developed these and showed them to Montgomery Wards, and they don't like any of them, and they want us to redo them, and we have a week or two to redo them in, and can you help us? I told him quickly, I said, well, the only thing I can do is, yes, I think maybe I can, but I'll have to have some paper and some pencils. And I said, then I want to be left alone. And I said, if you could come back, let me study them and work and come back maybe 8 or 9 o'clock after your dinner tonight. You get me a lot of coffee and then come back, and then you can see what maybe I think we could do for them. And then you can make a judgment on that.
And you got the account.
I got the account. That's
it.
Fantastic. And then from then on, we were eating.
You were eating. Hodgman Burke was a success.
I called up Claire Hodgman, reversed the charges because I didn't have any money in my pocket. I told him we got an account. And that was
he said, hooray. That was what?
And I think that was, held us for the next 4 or 5 months, and then they began to trickle in little by little.
Wonderful. That's a great story.
Yeah. At one time we had, close to 20 some odd people working for us, and we had an office in the Seagram's building, which is a really nice spot, and a battery of secretaries, and we were busy as heck.
Great.
We had a lot of fun.
Oh, great. That's marvelous. Thank you, Mr. Burke.
Well, thank you, sir.